one guide, the curriculum approaches and choices, or there's a million books out there. What do I do? You know, it really is bewildering. I remember walking in. The first conference we went to was in North Carolina, where they had like 5,000 to 6,000 people there. And there's so many books, I about had a panic attack. What the hell in the world am I supposed to choose something? How do you know what will work for your family? It helps if you have in mind what you want. Because the curricula that you see out there will come from different worldviews. Do you want something that is expressly Christian? And do you want it from a particular Christian tradition? Or is it non-denominational okay with you? Or do you want something that's secular? I just don't want any faith stuff in there at all. I want something secular. Or in North Carolina, we have a lot of homeschoolers that are Hindu and Muslim. You know, do you want something that represents another religion? You need to have in your mind what you want, because, you know, in math, it doesn't really matter who wrote the textbook, because 2 + 2 will always equal 4. But in history and in literature, it makes a huge difference. In science, it makes a huge difference. So have in your mind what kind of worldview you want it to come from. And what philosophy of education do you want it to happen? You know, homeschooling is one of the most exciting things going on in the educational world. And I went to graduate school in education. But homeschooling is really awesome because instead of being controlled by bureaucrats, instead of textbook publishers writing everything to please the textbook committee in Texas or the textbook committee in California, there's a bunch of curricula published by all kinds of small textbook companies. And so, actually, materials for homeschoolers have to compete in a marketplace. They have to be chosen by individual families. And that means there's a lot more out there, and there's a lot more variety out there. And you can choose it to fit your own ideas of what you want it to be. And so we're going to talk about some of those educational philosophies and some of the teaching and learning styles so that you can have an idea when you look at something, what kind of philosophy it comes from, and see if it matches your philosophy. The first one is one that is really growing, and that's public school at home. This can be virtual or online charter schools or public schools that are still owned by the public school system. They're still controlled by the public school system, but they're presented at home. Now, anytime you're looking at something that is a public-private partnership, okay, like that, you need to think about who has the control, who makes the decisions, and who spends the money. And usually, the person that's spending the money is making the decisions and has all the authority. And so a lot of people are attracted to public school at home options because they are free or cheap, not realizing that the cost is in that you give up your authority. They decide what's best for your child. They decide when your child meets the standards. They decide what your child needs. And so if they have the gold, they make the rules. You've heard that. He who has the gold makes the rules. When you spend your own money, you make the rules and you have the authority. Now, to a lot of parents, public school at home programs seem safe. People feel like, well, if I do that, then if I decide to put my child back in school, then they'll be still in the school system. It's often free. And people think that that means that mom's going to have to make fewer decisions and have less input. However, some of them, like K-12, for example, requires such minute bookkeeping, you have to keep track of every 12 minutes what your child is doing all day. So that doesn't require less work from mom, it requires more work from mom. The weaknesses are the public school textbooks and things are a bureaucratic committee's compromise. They're the things the textbook companies came up with to keep everybody on the Texas and California curriculum committees happy. Also, it's usually the same failed worldview and failed methods that you left, that you decided to leave in order to homeschool. And you lose all authority. They're the ones that make the decisions over your home. And most people say that this is not really homeschooling, because the essence of homeschooling is not the location where it's occurring, but who's in charge of it. Now, there's the traditional textbook approach. Now, this is similar to what we used growing up. where you have a separate textbook for every subject, and the material's pre-digested, it's formatted to fit one school year, it's broken into increments so that you can do it over a 180-day period, the traditional textbooks. Now, the strength of traditional textbooks is it's an easy adjustment from an institutional school because it looks like what you expect school textbooks to look like. And that's the way most of us learned. Now, it does work very well in the high school subjects, in math, in high school subjects, and the things that need to be more regimented in order for a child to progress. The weaknesses are, I see a lot of new homeschoolers say, okay, I want something that is going to just lay it out for me exactly what I'm supposed to do, so I'm going to buy the same curriculum that our local Christian school uses. The problem is that curriculum is not written to be used at home. It's written to be used in a classroom by a teacher. Now, what difference does that make? For example, one popular Christian school curriculum has so much written work that people just drown doing it. Why? Because the curriculum was never intended for every child to do every piece of written work. But the teacher would assign some of the work, and then the kids that got finished fast, she'd have something else to give them to keep them busy while she tutored the other kids. And so if you are a type A personality and have trouble picking and choosing and leaving things undone, you're going to struggle with a traditional written for the classroom textbook, because it's going to be really hard for you not to make your child do every single thing in there. Also, so it's going to need a traditional textbook approach that's written for the schools. Now, there's some traditional textbook approaches that are written for homeschools, but the ones that are written for the schools are going to need some adaptation to use at home. For example, if it's written for a classroom and it says, divide the children up into four groups, well, I only have three kids. What do I do? And one of them is a baby that can't even crawl yet. So it's going to need some adaptation, some changes made. Now, it's unnecessary to have a separate text for each subject for kids in elementary school. There's no reason this child should be studying Revolutionary War history, and this one Civil War history, and this one ancient history, and this one the history of the modern times. Why? When they can study all together and make it much easier and much less work for you. And much more fun for them. Now, some examples of the traditional textbook approach, things like Abeka, Bob Jones, Alpha Omega, for math, Saxon, for science, middle and high school Apologia. Elementary school Apologia is not a traditional textbook approach. And again, the traditional textbook approach works really well in math and up in high school subjects. Now, we're going to kind of go to the opposite extreme, and let's talk about unschooling. What in the world is unschooling? Unschooling is the child takes charge of their education. They study what they discover they need to know. They study what they're interested in. But it is influenced by the parents. The parents try to help them be interested in the right things and give them a very rich environment so that if they are looking for a book, they find a good one. And if they mention something they're interested in, mom makes sure there's resources about that subject ready. Now, the strengths of this is it's completely individualized to the child. It's child-driven. Now, it can be very useful in times of stress or if your child needs de-schooling. If you have a child who's traumatized by the schools, you know, sometimes people start homeschooling because the child's been bullied or the child's had a train wreck of an experience, then unschooling for a number of months can be very healing and help them to rediscover the love of learning. If mom's in the hospital and dad's trying to manage, unschooling may be the best way to manage right then. It doesn't have to be a forever thing. And it can be a lot of fun. And often you'll find that some kids get so excited about learning, they kind of move into that themselves, and you don't have to drive them anymore because they're so excited about learning, they're driving their own education. Now, the weaknesses are it's a lot of work. People think that this is an easy way for parents. But instead, the parent has to be super proactive and super thoughtful to mold and shape the child without being directive. It's a lot easier to say, study this, than it is to create enough exciting things to make the child want to study that. Okay? And it's hard to keep records. It's hard to document. So it's very unusual to see someone unschooling in high school, for example. Now, the parents of a child with self-discipline issues are going to probably find out that the child's education isn't progressing like it needs to. Because the child doesn't want to do math, ever, and doesn't see any need for it. And that can be difficult. And also, pure unschooling doesn't really take into account a child's sin nature. That they may just be ornery, or rebellious, or lazy, and not want to do it. Some examples, the book Growing Without Schooling by John Holt, the Unschooling Handbook. Now, the Relaxed Homeschooler by Mary Hood is a little bit more balanced approach. It's from a Christian worldview, so it assumes you're going to have to do some direction. And people call that more relaxed homeschooling or delight-directed homeschooling, in that the parent's still in charge, but they are making sure that the child has an opportunity to follow their interests and delights. Yes?
This is a question.
I would be glad to do that. If y'all sign up for our newsletter, and I don't have any cards on me that we made a mistake this morning, but they'll be here all weekend. You can get them at our booth. Sign up for our newsletter. And it's raising, if you can't miss it, it's the one with the guns and the swords. Okay? On the top level, walk in, right in front of you, guns and swords, and our book, Raising Real Men. You'll see it. Great Waters Press is the name of our company, Raising Real Men.
And
Melanie Young. And when you, so sign up for our newsletter and write on the back curriculum, and I'll send you some notes, okay? Another philosophy of education you'll see represented a lot among homeschoolers is what we call the Living Books or Charlotte Mason approach. Charlotte Mason was an educational reformer in the late 1800s, and she wanted to create a passion for learning in children. And so she describes learning as the lighting of a fire instead of just filling a bucket. The distinctiveness about Charlotte Mason is an emphasis on living books, on real literature and not pre-digested textbooks. And on real books, nonfiction books, not just textbooks. In the hopes that these things written by people who are enthusiasts will make education come alive for kids. The strength of that is it does encourage a love of learning and gets rid of busy work. And it tends to create independent learners because they learn to love learning. And being able to draw material out of a real book is a life skill. It'll do you a lot of good in the future. If you learn how to teach yourself things, then you can learn anything you want to as an adult. And nature study, teaching kids to not just have their face in the screen, but to get out and hike and collect wildlife and look things up, that's one of the strengths of Charlotte Mason. Some of the weaknesses is there's less available from the Charlotte Mason perspective for older kids, and you're probably going to need to incorporate some different philosophies as your child moves into high school. Some examples, the book For the Children's Sake by Susan Schaefer McCauley. The company Simply Charlotte Mason has some fantastic Charlotte Mason resources. Five in a Row, Sunlight, Simply Grammar, Apologia Sciences Elementary textbooks. They look like textbooks, but they're written from a Charlotte Mason perspective, and so they are very readable. They're good for read aloud. They have hands-on activities for you and your children to share. And the Charlotte Mason Girl is another good resource. And I know we're galloping through this and you feel overwhelmed. I just want to kind of give you a taste so that you have an idea of these different approaches. And as you see these things, you'll begin to understand what I'm talking about better, okay? Now, classical education is another philosophy you see commonly among homeschoolers. This is the way early Americans were taught. It focuses on the three stages of education. In elementary school, children memorize and build up a store of facts. In the middle school years, they begin to use logic and make connections between subjects. And then in high school, they learn to put it all together and express it and defend it and begin to specialize more. Now, the strengths of a classical education perspective is it produces self-learners and very well-educated students who participate in what we call the great conversation. The great conversation means that the great books of the Western world that impacted Martin Luther and Winston Churchill and Oliver Cromwell and Theodore Roosevelt, we can read those same books that they read as kids And we can be impacted in the same way. It's like participating in a conversation that's been going on for 2,000 years. Does that make sense? And it teaches kids to love the great influences of our culture. Now, the weaknesses, it can be pretty intimidating. Because let's face it, most of us did not have a very thorough education. And I know I had, when I sat down to start teaching our kids and we said, okay, we're going to read the Iliad, I started reading and I thought, you know, there was a little scrap from it in my high school literature textbook. And it's really a fascinating story. And it's quite readable. I thought, why didn't they just assign us to read the book? But most of us have never read these things. And so it's kind of intimidating at first. So the teacher's going to be learning too. Now, some strict classical education models can be a little impractical. You know, we've done Latin with some of our kids, not with others. Not every child needs Latin. In fact, not every child's equipped to learn those things. And so, you know, you're probably, if you teach from a classical perspective, you have to be really careful not to feel like you have to check off all these boxes. And instead, you need to look at the needs of your child and see, what does this child need? And some people that push a classical perspective make you think you can't do it unless you do it exactly their way or with their class or, you know, according to their system, and that's just not true. Some examples of classical education materials: Veritas Press, Trivium Pursuit, Tapestry of Grace, The Well-Trained Mind. Now, what we're seeing more and more of in homeschooling are classes and co-ops. And these can be taught by paid or volunteer teachers that will present either some of the concepts or all of them that you need in a particular subject area for the entire school year. Now, classes and co-ops may be expensive, they might be free, they might be just cost some. They can be local, where you meet together with five other families and you teach literature and one of them teaches science. Or it can be online, where you never meet the teacher face-to-face at all, but your child attends a class live online or even watches videos. And classes and co-ops can come from any educational perspective. You need to ask, what educational perspective does this come from? Now, the strengths of this is that can be a real help in specialized situations like science labs, you know, that you may not feel qualified to do a high school chemistry. You are, but you may not feel qualified. You can sign up and do a lab with some other homeschoolers or with a teacher who understands. Or music instruction. Everybody in my family is musical, and I didn't get that gene. And so I'm very thankful for our homeschool band and for piano lessons that I can take my children and have them do those things that I can't do. It can be an encouragement to stay up with the rest of the group. You know, it can provide some accountability, and it can provide some fellowship, get you out of the house doing things together. The weaknesses are, there are some people, particularly those doing it for money, who make you feel like you're somehow a subpar homeschooler if you don't do it with them. Not true. Every family is different. You've got to do what's best for your family. And it can be a temptation if you fit in really well and you love the other mothers and you're meeting together every weekend and you're having so much fun, to stay in the co-op even if it's not a good match for your child. Got to remember, that's not why we're homeschooling. Find a homeschool support group that you could be in without the co-op if you need to get your child out of that class, okay? You need to think about your child's needs. And you lose some flexibility and freedom when you sign up with a class because you've got to go along at their pace instead of saying, oh, Dad has a field trip to Arizona, let's all go to Arizona next week. Instead, you're stuck because you have a class, unless you can talk to the teacher and get permission to do otherwise. And some of them can be quite expensive. Some examples: Classical Conversations, Veritas Press Scholars Academy. A lot of local support groups have co-ops. And then there's online classes. We love David Vogel's Living the Answer. Our kids have done several of those. Apology Academy, we've done those. Pennsylvania Homeschoolers, we've done that. We've done Patrick Henry Academy. Veritas Press Self-Paced, we haven't done that one yet, but I know people who have. We've had four go through high school. Now my fifth is in high school. And in high school, yeah, we pick usually each child one class a year to do outside the home so that they have someone else who can speak to their qualifications when they need recommendation letters for college. Now, unit studies, what is that? That's where you take a theme or a topic and you study all kinds of things related to that theme over a period of time. You can combine several different grade levels. You can combine subjects together. So for example, I might say, okay, we're going to study birds. And so we're going to get all the books on birds at the library on all the different levels. And we're going to go to 4-H, to the cooperative extension agent, and she's going to loan us an egg hatcher, and we're going to hatch eggs and hatch baby chicks. And we're going to build a bird feeder and put it outside, and we're going to get a bird guide, and we're going to identify the birds, and we're going to write stories about birds, and we're going to keep track, and we're going to, of how many birds visit our feeder, and we're going to do math graphs about how many birds are visiting the feeder. And so we take that theme and take it into a bunch of different subjects. It's fun. Now, the strengths is all ages are studying together. And this is great for building friendships among your kids, because one of the big parts of friendship is sharing interest. And when your kids do things together, it builds friendships among them that was very different from, like, my brother and I growing up, that were never, ever in the same class, didn't really even have the same friends. But your kids can do things together and have the same experience, so that if you've been studying sea life and you're on the way to the beach and somebody says, oh, look, a whale can pulls up a shell that's got the creature still in it. Then everybody gathers around and everyone's excited about it because you've all been studying it together. It's very motivating. Promotes a love of learning. It works well in science, history, and literature in the elementary and middle school years. The weakness is if you try to use unit studies for everything, you can leave gaps. And so you do need some structure, particularly in grammar and math, to make sure you get everything in. And it's a little bit harder to keep records. You have to keep more of a narrative than page 222, okay? And if you try to do too much, some moms get so excited about giving their kids an exciting education that they wear themselves out. And sometimes it's awkward combining subjects. If you're studying the Middle Ages, you're going to have a really hard time talking about computers and connecting it to the Middle Ages, all right? Some examples of curricula that are used to produce unit studies. You can produce unit studies on your own, but some of the curricula: Konos, Trail Guide to Learning, Prairie Prima, Literature Lessons from Lord of the Rings, The Weaver, Trisms, Once a Week Unit Studies. There's a lot out there to help you with that. Now, eclectic. What is this? This is when you combine elements from several different philosophies to make a unique program to fit a particular family. And this is probably what most homeschool families eventually do. The strengths are it takes the best from all the approaches, and it's easy to individualize for your situation needs, and you have freedom. The weaknesses are sometimes you can use things that are like diametrically opposed in philosophy, and you need to think about that when you're combining things. And it does take some thinking and decision-making to choose stuff from different philosophies. Some examples of a more eclectic approach: My Father's World, the Timberdoodle curriculum packs, and what many families put together themselves. Now, I know your question is, how do I decide? What in the world? What am I going to do? How do I decide what to do with my child? I don't want to make a mistake. Okay, here's some basic principles. It's not forever. Okay, what you decide today, you don't have to use next year. In fact, you don't have to use it next week. If you get it home and it stinks and it doesn't match your family, there's a great market for used homeschool curriculum. Just sell it and move on, okay? Now, I want you to think mostly a good bit and very little. What do I mean? I want you to think mostly about what your child needs. Think a good bit about what works for you and your teaching style. And very little about what their grandparents think, what your friends think, what your fellow homeschoolers think. Very little about what other people think. Because your goal is to glorify God, to meet your child's needs, and do it in a way that you can handle. Okay? Now, this is a key principle. I want you to write this one down. Don't choose a hard-to-use curriculum in a difficult subject. Okay? If you hate math, choose an easy-to-use math program. Now, this is really hard, and it's kind of counterintuitive. Because, see, let's say you love art and hate math. Well, when you go out there and you see the expensive, gorgeous videos, art projects, and art supplies included curriculum, you're going to want to buy it.
And you're going to want to save $10 to buy a use a math book because you hate math. Bad move. Because you would teach your children art if all you had was a piece of charcoal and a paper bag because you love art. But you're going to need something good and easy to use to teach math. Okay? So spend your money in the subjects you hate. Okay? And the more you hate the subject, the more directive it should be. I have a friend who's very loosey-goosey artsy, and she found a chemistry curriculum where you had to discover chemistry. And it just matched her personality. She thought, this is going to be great. So she found three or four other loosey-goosey artsy moms, and they got together to have a chemistry co-op for their high school students. And the first week they called me and they said, Melanie, what in the world does a rodent have to do with chemistry? My degree's in biology and chemistry. I said, what in the world are you talking about? I said, they told us to find out what a mole was. What is a rodent? I said, okay, no. Have you ever heard of Avogadro's number? She said, avocados, what does vegetables have to do with this? I explained that a mole is a number of atoms. Told her how to find the right answer. The next week when they called, I said, you know, I don't think this is the chemistry curriculum for you guys. Because, frankly, Libby, you ain't never going to discover chemistry. So, instead, in a subject you're uncertain in, choose one that says, say this to the children. Ask them this question. When they say this, if they answer A, do that. If they answer B, do this. Because in the subjects you don't feel confident in, you need something to tell you what to do. Okay? Now, pick something you want to use. Pick something that gets you excited, that looks interesting, that makes you want to turn the page and see what happens next. Because you've got a lot of freedom in homeschooling. And if you come downstairs and you don't want to open that book, you might not open it. So choose something you want to use and spend what you can afford. More expensive is not necessarily best in homeschooling. Some of the very best, most solid curriculum we've used are the ones that were the cheapest. You know, we used a phonics workbooks to reinforce phonics skills with our kids. They were like $3 each. They were put out by Mennonites and Amish people. But they were fantastic. They were solid. They were good. So, you know, more money does not necessarily equal better. Spend what you can spend. Don't put yourself in the poorhouse trying to buy the most expensive stuff. Okay, some more basic principles. Ask people for advice. Ask them what they love, what their favorite curriculum is, but be careful. Look at them and ask yourself, how much like my family is this family? For example, I have a sweet dear friend that for years would choose whatever I chose for a curriculum. The problem is my kids are all outgoing and talkative and active and loud. I had 6 boys in a row and then 2 girls. Her oldest son is a selective mute and doesn't speak outside their family. Her other children are almost that quiet. And so she chose the grammar curriculum I used. My grammar curriculum required you to stand up and do dances and do chants, and my kids loved it. And her kids, she told them to sing the noun song, and they looked at her and said, can I just die? It'd be way easier, Mama. Okay. Bad move. So you can't just say, oh, I want to be like that family and use whatever they use, because their children may be different than yours. Okay? Again, think mostly about what your child needs, a good bit about what works for you, and very little about what anyone else thinks. Now, I have several friends who sell homeschool curriculum. And they tell me almost nobody buys the solutions manual. And I say, wow, I thought homeschoolers were smarter than that. Always buy the solutions manual. Do you really want to rediscover Algebra 2 this year? I don't. Let me tell you how the solutions manual works. This is so awesome. I use it all the time. I'm teaching my 4th Algebra 2. I had calculus in college. I can do that stuff. But do I want to think about it at 9 o'clock in the morning? No way. Not with the 8 other kids asking for attention. You know, no. So he comes and he says, Mom, would you show me how to do this problem? I say, sure. Look, this is going to be easy. You're going to love this problem. But hand me your solutions manual. Let me see how Mr. Saxon wants you to do this problem. And make sure that we're doing it the way he's taught you. Okay, then you open up the solutions manual, and it shows you step by step what to do. You say, okay, look, first you do this. And then you do that. And then you do this. And do you see this? And he goes, oh, Mom, you're so smart. Buy the solutions manual. Likewise, buy the lab kit that goes with your science. Okay, because you're going to look at it, and you're going to look at the list, and you say, Epsom salt, I can get that at Walmart. Oh, glycerin, I saw that the other day at CVS. And you're going to think you're going to save some money by gathering those things yourselves. But what's going to happen? Wednesday's going to roll around. Mama, I'm scheduled to do a science experiment today. And you look down the list of materials and know you hadn't gotten in advance. And you realize it's going to take 3 stops to find them, and in 1 you're going to have to go to the next town. And you don't do the experiment that day, do you? And do you do it tomorrow? Probably not. And by the time you've actually remembered to make those 3 stops, and you've got them all at home, and you remember science, they're not going to remember the concept. And so get the lab kit, because that way he can say, Mom, I'm supposed to do a science experiment. You say, go get your general science lab kit, son. It's all right there. When? Okay? Make it easy for yourself. And consider your situation. And we've had all kinds of situations. Right now, we're full-time speakers. We travel all over the country. Is it going to work for me to use a curriculum where I have to sit next to my child all the time, each individual child? No, it's going to be hard because we're schooling in the van. If you have a grandparent who is in the nursing home and you're the only person caring for them and you're having to go there every day to make sure that they eat, you need something that's portable. If you are, on the other hand, at home and the husband's lost his job and the only money coming in is mama's blog, and so mom's having to stay on the computer a lot, having a curriculum that the kids need to use the computer isn't going to work very well. And so consider your situation, and that's going to change from year to year. Some years you're going to have more money and less time, and some years you're going to have more time but no money. And so just you can change it from year to year. Also, ladies, talk to your husbands. Because just talking it out, guys are really good at having the long-term perspective. Now, guys, okay, be careful about that. There is no need to panic that they didn't get any school done and your child won't get into college when they're 4 years old. Okay, and I hear that a lot. Moms call me, my husband's putting so much stress on us. Every day he comes home and he says, how much did y'all get done in school today? I'm worried they're not going to be able to get into college. How old are your kids? 5 and 3. Chill out, Dad. They didn't do any school till they were 8. They could get into college, no problem. Okay? And so, but in the curriculum choosing, Dad, that long-term perspective that husbands have is so valuable. Because he's going to understand, you know, the spelling curriculum you choose is probably not a life-altering decision. And moms can freak out about stuff like that. And dads can say, well, and moms too will freak out over spending money. I love to see dads come by our booth because moms will come and they'll pick up a CD and they'll read it and they'll put it down and they'll walk back and they'll stop 5 times that day and think about buying that $5 CD. And the next day dad comes in and she says, honey, I'm thinking about getting the CD, but it's not strictly curriculum, so I don't know if I should spend the money. And says, do you think it'll help you? Well, yeah, I do. Okay, we'll get it, but it says buy 4, get 1 free. Why don't you pick out some more? Dad's got a little bit more perspective. Sometimes we moms strain over gnats, and meanwhile the camel dies, okay? And so talk to your husband about it and pray. The Lord really does care about what happens in your homeschool, and he really will guide you into making wise decisions for your children, so pray about what you're deciding. Okay, now you're thinking, you didn't tell me, what do I buy? I want to know, what do I buy? Okay, how do you choose curriculum? First of all, for us, we're Christians. The most important thing is that we spend time with our children in the Word of God. And we have devotions every day. And my husband says, if you don't have time to have devotions with your kids, you don't have time to do school. And so we just use the Bible. We don't use a curriculum. There's a lot of good curricula out there. But Hal and I both have been Christians a long time. We're very comfortable just discussing the Bible with our children. We just choose a book we're going to study through. We read a passage. And talk about it, what it means with the kids. We do some memory work. We use a Baptist catechism for kids, the catechism for boys and girls. It's really cute to see a 3-year-old. Who made you? God made me. What else did God make? God made all things. Love it. We memorize some Bible verses, and we sing songs. We have a hymn of the week every week, and we sing that same hymn every day for a week, and our children have learned tons of hymns that way and tons of Christian songs, and we pray together. And then you want to choose the basics, okay? Each child is going to need something in reading, writing, and math, writing grammar, okay, and math on their level. Now, some of you have got kids in school, you're thinking, I don't know what their level is. Well, you may not know. You can, some curricula have tests you can take. Like if you're going to put them in Saxon math, you go out to the Saxon Publishers website, and they have a test you can print out and give them to figure out what level they need to be in. You might be able to check their records from the schools. Request a copy of the records. You have a right to do that. And look at how they've tested in the past. Be aware, though, that if you have a fifth grader who tests 11th grade on a test, that does not mean they're prepared to do 11th grade work. What that means is they tested on the fifth grade test, like an 11th grader might. That means they knew everything on the fifth grade test, but there was no 11th grade material on that test. So that can be accurate within a year. If they tested sixth grade, that means they've done with the fifth grade work. If they tested fourth grade, they don't know the fifth grade work yet. But once you get past a year, either way, that's not accurate. And you know what? Guess and go if you need to. If they're doing pretty well in school, buy them something that's the equivalent for their age and try it out. If they're struggling, get something maybe a year younger and try it out. And if it doesn't work, sell it to a friend and get the next level, or save it for the younger brother, or save it for next year. So how do you choose curriculum? Okay, I recommend that you combine all your younger children, like middle school younger, in history, science, and literature. It's going to be a lot easier for you. It's less stressful. There's no reason. In North Carolina, we study state history in the fourth and the eighth grade in the public schools. But in other states, it's third and seventh, or second and fifth. It doesn't matter what year you study state history, as long as you study state history. And so it's okay if this year your sixth grade, fourth grade, second grade, and kindergartner are all studying Revolutionary War history, and next year we're all going to study modern history. Okay, so it's okay to combine them all, just so long they get that a basic level of knowledge before they hit high school. And you can also spend that time you save instead of trying to teach each child separately. When you're teaching them together, you can do some memorable and fun projects together. Our kids still talk about the Roman feast we held and invited their grandparents, and that was 25 years ago. Okay, so you want to choose a topic or curriculum and look for what works for you, and then you adapt it to suit different ages. So, like, say we're going to study ancient history. I want to get some kind of textbook or book that's going to explain to me what it's about, because my ancient history may not be that great. And I'm going to use that to give me ideas of what to study in what order. So choose kind of a spine, something to keep you directed, even if your kids never even see it, okay? Then go to the library and choose books on that topic in different areas. Say we're going to study the Civil War. Well, there's Civil War picture books, and there's Civil War easy readers, and there's Civil War young readers, and there's adult Civil War books. Get some of everything and take it home. And then make a plan for what you're going to do. Now, if you choose a curriculum that does this, the curriculum will be your plan. If you're doing, it's a good idea to plan maybe an extra week every quarter with nothing planned to do, to catch up, to make up for the doctor's visits and the days when everyone had a meltdown and the day everybody woke up with a stomach flu. And you can use it for projects if you don't need it for anything else. And enjoy it. So how do you use this stuff? How do you do it? Okay. To use the curriculum, this is what you do. To get ready to plan, first you're going to open your books, read the introduction and the notes to the teacher. Seems pretty obvious, but very few people do. It will tell you how the curriculum is meant to be used. Okay? Then study the table of contents and look at what's needed to complete it. If it has 9 units, There's about 9 months of the school year. You can do that again in a month, right? If it has 150 lessons plus 20 tests, that means you're going to do a lesson a day and a test every 4 or 5 days. That's like a typical math curriculum. Okay? But look at how much you're going to have to complete in a week to get it done in a year. And then you're going to sit down and plan for the year. A year is typically 36 weeks. That's 9 months, 36 weeks, 4 quarters of 9 weeks each. Now, again, if you'll write curriculum on the back of your newsletter cards that you pick up this week in our booth, I will send you some planning forms that will help you do this, okay? How long is a year? How much do you need to do each week? Now, you might find out, like, for example, if you're looking at your typical handwriting program, there's going to be about 60 lessons in your typical handwriting program. That's going to be about 2 a week and some weeks off. So you're only going to have handwriting 2 days a week. Typical math, there's going to be something every day. Grammar, there might be something every day, but a week off every quarter. So figure out how much you're going to need to do each week to get it done in a year and plan that out. Do not plan every day at the beginning of the year. Instead, just plan how much you're going to do each week. Okay? Then, the week before your week, like I'll plan this week for next week. Why do I wait till then to plan? Why don't I plan months in advance for each day? You don't know what's going to happen. You know, the kids might all have the flu. I'm going to have to plan some really light couple of weeks here. In fact, we're going to do a lot of looking at educational videos. Or I might have 8 doctor's appointments the next 2 weeks. So you want to plan. Now, when you sit down to plan, you can take into account your schedule. If you have dentist appointments on Wednesday, don't plan your science experiments for Wednesday. Instead, you plan them for Tuesday or Thursday. And you don't like the mess of science experiments, so you're not going to do science experiments every day. You're going to pick 1 day a week, and you're going to do all the experiments for that week, right? And so plan it to work for you. That means maybe if Dad gets home, he works third shift, and he gets home at 7 a.m., and he wants to spend some time with the kids, you might do better schooling in the afternoon. That's okay. Plan what works for you. Now, some final thoughts. Curriculum is a tool. Make it serve you. Don't serve your curriculum. Okay, if it's not working for you, adapt it or get rid of it. If you don't hear about the wonderful field trip to the amazing Railroad Museum and say, well, we're 1 day behind on our math workbook, and miss the field trip. Who cares about the 1 day behind? If you have to make it up at all, you can make it up this summer. You make it up next week. They can do 2 workbook sheets tomorrow. Okay, but don't cut out the things that will make your children love learning because you're a slave to your curriculum. Your curriculum is your slave to help you teach your kids. And remember, there's so much more to homeschooling than academics. I was completely freaked out about academics when we started homeschooling. I was so panicked. I want our kids to learn 2 other languages. I was concerned they have calculus by the time they graduated. I was really super, super academic. But now, as we have 4 adult children, I realized that it was way more important the time we spent with our kids, the relationship we developed with them, the way we're able to disciple them in the love of God, and the way that we gave them a love of learning. Because that love of learning, even the things we didn't get done, if they were important, our kids did it on their own. Or they did it in college because they love to learn. And so don't sacrifice the things that will matter for your children's life, like discipleship and character and relationship and love of learning, for the things that no one will ever ask about again. Nobody really cares if you finished your 5th grade math book. They will not ask you when they apply to Oxford, I promise. And I had a child go to Oxford. And so they don't care what he did in the 5th grade. So be free, okay? Do what's important. And remember that the Lord will stand in the gap. I remember being super, super, super worried because I had promised our kids a space unit, and we ended up moving. We're going to study outer. We're going to study space. And I couldn't do it because we were trying to get the house ready to go on the market. We were trying to move. And I felt like a failure. But, you know, it's interesting. On the way out of town, one of my friends said, Melanie, stop by the house. I've got something for you on the way out of town. I stopped by, and she gave me a bag of Dorling Kindersley books. They're really beautiful books with lots of photographs. And they were all focused on space exploration and the planets. And, wow. So we're driving. We lived in Louisiana at the time. We were moving to North Carolina. We stopped in Huntsville, Alabama to see my brother. And we planned two nights hotel. It was very hard to afford that at that time because we wanted to spend some time with my brother. I hadn't seen him in a long time. And he gets there that night. And he says, I can't spend tomorrow with you. I thought, oh, no. We're going to sit here in a strange town with nothing to do. He said, but I wonder if you'd like to visit the National Space Museum. I got you tickets. Would we ever? So we went to the National Space Museum. And as we're walking along there, I see a little sign that says, teachers that way. So I'm a teacher, and I went back there, and they handed me full-color posters of all the planets in a moon unit cardboard model we could make, in a space unit that we could do, and we did it on the way up to North Carolina. And we pull into my mom's driveway, and she said, don't get out of the van. I said, what do you mean, don't get out of the van? We got to get out of the van. She said, no, there's an eclipse tonight. I want to take you to go see it. And we jumped in, and we drove, and we saw the eclipse. And the night we moved into our new house, we pulled into the driveway, and I looked across, and I saw for the first and last time in my life a comet. And tears came to my eyes. And I realized that God cared far more about my schooling than I thought. And that when I had done all that I could, that he would stand in the gaps. And he has way better audio visuals than I do. Don't worry. Welcome to homeschooling. It really is, and it has been for us, the adventure of a lifetime. I would like to invite you to stop by our booth. It's called Great Waters Press. I don't even know if they were able to put up the banners down there or not. I doubt it since we had to gather just the essentials to bring in the van because our poor trailer is down in Connecticut. This is our book. If you enjoy listening to a speaker, you're going to love our book. It's Raising Real Men, Surviving, Teaching, and Appreciating Boys. 2011 Christian Small Publishers Book of the Year. It's available in hard copy and audiobook because we find a lot of dads like audiobooks to listen to as they drive. And if you need some cheering up in your family, this is an attitude change in our house. This is the classic book, Pollyanna. My daughter found it in a used bookstore and asked me to read it, and I didn't want to because it sounded boring and didactic, but I couldn't stop laughing. It was hilarious. And then my teenage boys were saying, Mom, are you reading Pollyanna in there? Can you wait until I'm done with the dishes? I wanted to hear it. Everybody loved it, and it taught us to be more grateful. And so we turned it into an audiobook. We have this and other classic living books available in audiobook down at our booth. We'd love for you to come check it out. And we have a free podcast. You can find us on iTunes or HelenMelanie.com/radio. Called Making Biblical Family Life Practical. We're live on Monday nights at 9 o'clock, and we talk about all kinds of topics that affect your family. Thank you very much.